Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman, sharing stories of our food. And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman. Today, I'm joined by my good friend and confidant, Scott Soros. Hey, Scott.
How are you, Aaron?
Long trip from Longmeadow today?
Not too bad. Yeah. Traffic was kind to me today.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah. I was all ready to get. I usually leave really early in the morning, come down to the studio, kind of prep, get things ready. I was up late last night. Those Bruins, whew, you know, keep me up late. And then I slept in a little bit, so I had to deal with traffic. That's never fun.
Yeah, in fact, I even got here a little bit early, so I didn't have to rush in my frantic usual pace.
Smart guy. Look at that. We're all learning. Yeah, continue to learn.
That's right.
All right. Hey, Scott Soros, a little bit about your background. Scott Soros is the former commissioner of Massachusetts Agriculture and served as the director of USDA Rural Development for Connecticut, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island for the Obama administration. Scott has 15 years of fishery and aquaculture experience, part of that including early in his career serving as the first Massachusetts coordinator of aquaculture for nearly a decade. Recently, along with a few ventures promoting the bounty of New England's waters to a much broader audience, Soros has taken the role of the Mass Shellfish Initiative coordinator. So, Scott, what is the Mass Shellfish Initiative, and how is it designed to help our regional producers and the seafood industry in New England?
Sure. Well, first and foremost, Massachusetts isn't the first to do this. It's actually a result of NOAA, the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration, announcing back in 2011 that they wanted to see these shellfish initiatives for the broad range of benefits they bring, not only economic, but also environmental from shellfish populations themselves. So Massachusetts Shellfish Initiative, or the MSI, was really an effort to bring together a forum of all of the various shellfish stakeholders that are out there. Try to say that 10 times fast.
Yeah.
Including wild harvesters, recreational and commercial, as well as aquaculture, which is one of the fastest growing forms of food production at this point, if not in the U.S., globally, and habitat restoration work. So the really effort is to bring all of those different voices together to identify priorities, opportunities, and to see where we can move forward to ultimately increase and maximize economic sustainability opportunities around shellfish.
Interesting. And there's some economic drivers here, too, because when we were at the Seafood Expo New England show, we had a chance to listen in and hear somewhat was going on with the ability to get New England or all domestic U.S. shellfish into some of the European markets and how those skids have been greased recently. What's the status on that? What do we learn, and where can this, what can this mean for our producers to enter new markets?
Yeah, well, primarily because of the way that the European health authorities and the U.S. health authorities, primarily the FDA, the way they looked at how you measure the safety of shellfish in particular, back in 2009, they stopped those shipments. So it's only been recently that now they've opened the door back up to look at providing access to the EU, but they're piloting it really only with two states at this point. Washington State and Massachusetts are the only two states that are being looked at. And likewise, on the EU side, the Netherlands and Spain are the two countries that are being looked at on the EU side. And the hope is that it will open up the door for more shellfish export activity from the U.S. To the EU, but keep in mind that we'll also likely see product coming here to the U.S. from the EU at the same time. Not a bad thing, because as I mentioned, with the fastest growing form of food production as aquaculture, we're seeing a lot of shellfish production here and abroad. So expanding markets, expanding more opportunities for people to access good, healthy, safe shellfish is a great opportunity for all of us, including the growers here in the U.S. So we're on the verge now of making that happen. It still is to be determined exactly when they'll pull the trigger. For the last several months now, they've been saying it'll be a couple of weeks, it'll be a couple of weeks, and it's continuing to go on. And by they, it's the health authorities both here in the U.S. And in the EU, although the EU is a bit ahead of us. They've already identified their priorities, but the FDA here is still a little bit slow on getting the authority and the approval done so that we can start that trade for our shellfish to the EU.
Well, maybe we'll counterbalance as the EU takes their summer vacation for a couple months off. We can counterbalance what the FDA can maybe put together, right, if we stay open.
Yep.
And who wants those stinking French oysters anyhow, right? I mean, come on, let's put some good New England, Massachusetts, maybe some Duxbury oysters right into the 81 million Germans that eat it during the holidays, right?
That's right.
Good potential here to give our producers some new market share. So right. Good stuff.
Yeah.
Well, I just want to express kind of a good cue up for our conversation today. The discussion of international seafood exchange has become a bit more mainstream recently. At nearly $140 billion globally, seafood is the largest food commodity traded. But the notion of seafood as a single stream of nameless foodstuff entering the global market from Never Never Land is changing. And as it turns out, it's not just driven by the consumer seeking integrity and backstory of this well-sourced food. That's something we focus a lot on in Sourcing Matters, is the consumer is the driving change, the change agent. But this intro is about geopolitical and macroeconomic models that are increasingly impacting how your seafood will be sourced. Sounds a little boring, I know, but I'll get to the point here. What's interesting is the very platform that made international trade so cheap and desirable could be ultimately its demise. With the increase of U.S. tariffs on Chinese seafood going from 10% to 25%, the industry is bracing for some unsettled waters. Oh, another pun, right? There you go. And more questions about market force and focus on ongoing international trade disputes are surely looming. Tilapia will be one of the hardest hit seafood products coming from China into the U.S. market. To give some statistics behind that, in spite of 10% tariffs that went into effect last September, the U.S. imported 142,000 metric tons of tilapia worth around $450 million in 2018, 6% more in volume and 5% more than 2017. So we're going up in tilapia, Chinese tilapia, the ultimate commodity fish coming into our markets. Remember, this is not because it's a better fish or a healthier fish or tastes better or it's ethically sourced or it's responsibly raised. No, it's because it's cheap. It's dirt cheap stuff coming into our markets. So let's not forget this is a two-way street. Also, more tariffs will be slapped on diverse allotments of seafood coming from the U.S. into China, which is important because they are the largest export market for U.S. seafood industry. Some context, by 2025, 40% of all global seafood will be consumed in China. China. In 2017, about almost $1 billion worth of sales of Alaskan seafood alone went into China. That's more than 50% of the state's seafood product being sold. According to the Alaska Seafood Marketing Initiative, as many as 65% of Alaska seafood businesses have lost sales as a result of the trade dispute with China, while 50% have reported sales delays and 36% have lost consumers in China, and another 21% say they have unanticipated costs. So it is affecting both markets coming into the U.S. and, you know, from our producers going into a much larger market share. So to counter this market evolution, Alaska alone, kind of using them as an example, Alaska seafood industry is exploring new and non-traditional markets to expand their seafood brands. And what those market innovations and new customers will look like is to be determined, but we know we again have changing waters. So is it time for us to read the tea leaves here, to rejigger this global commodity exchange through promoting and amplifying differentiation as a strategy of decommoditization? Today, we welcome a guest with some impressive background in this space, a guest seeking to promote the values of his seafood to more engaged consumers set on leveraging seafood as a mechanism of improving personal well-being and to invest in environmental and social change. Today, we welcome the Chief Sustainability Officer, of the iconic New England brand, Stavis Seafood, Richard Stavis. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Aaron. I got to say, I love listening to your podcast, and one of the challenges I have is that you're so provocative in your introduction that I have about five things I want to say in response just to what you've said so far.
Well, have at it. Let's go. Start in, please. what are your comments on that? Because you deal with this daily. So what are we doing here?
Well, I mean, there's a couple things, and this is what's interesting. This is why, you know, and I was saying to Scott before this whole thing started, you know, I feel badly for the consumer who needs to make sense out of all this because there's such complexities to everything that's going on here, and there really isn't a guide to help you through it. You know, one of the things to understand when you talk about how much Alaskan fish goes to China, the vast majority of the fish that goes to China goes there to be reprocessed to come to the United States. And you know, what's happening right now, some of it, the cod, for example, there's a specific exemption for it to be reprocessed and sent back to the United States. But salmon, there isn't. So we're going to see some disruptions in that product is not going to go to China to be reprocessed. But what it means is that we're going to have trouble being able to get our fish processed for us to eat. You know, and it's been shown that when product is reprocessed in China, which we can either like or not like that practice, you know, it's being done partly because it's cheaper labor practices, but quite frankly, it's also being done because they've invested more infrastructure. They've invested in the equipment, the machinery, and the processing plants, something which you can't easily slide to another country. But it's you know, we're going to have more difficulty getting our fish back to us for us to eat. And that's something that kind of gets lost in this whole tariff, you know, tariff and trade dispute. You know, so when you talk about China as a customer of Alaskan fish, maybe not so much. That's actually more fish that we're eating. When you talk about tilapia being important because it's a cheap fish, I think that that's part of what's going on. Part of what's going on is that it's also a mild fish, and it's been marketed, and it's been marketed as a fish that's available 52 weeks a year. And I honestly think that the consistency of availability is something that's more important to people, maybe even than price. I think there are cheaper and better options out there, and I think that we can create the opportunity to have cheaper and better options. And, you know, and I'll just give you one example, and this is where we need to work on creating our infrastructure. We have a large resource of haddock off of the Northeast. And part of the problem that we've had that we've created over time is number one, that we have fished this species over many years to the point where it's sort of been biologically trained to be a smaller size than what the market has historically considered to be prime size. Ironically enough, those sizes of fillet are the sizes that are typically the sizes that tilapia would come into the market in, you know, as opposed to larger sizes that haddock historically would be. But the problem is that we don't have infrastructure here in the United States to process the haddock. So the haddock gets shunted to the fresh market. And because the fish comes to the market in unpredictable ways, it's a very boom or bust kind of a situation. So when there's a large landing of haddock, the prices go through the floor, which means that the fishermen can't recoup the money that it cost them to go fish it. So we're only, you know, last I heard, I think we were only getting 11 or 12% of their quota, only fishing that amount and bringing it in. If we can create the infrastructure to process this haddock and to make the fillets domestically, you know, based upon what's happening with the price, we could potentially make a fillet that would be domestic, that would be a marine protein as opposed to freshwater, that would have a much better flavor profile and nutritional component, and that would compete in terms of price. You know, in, you know, all the tilapia we're bringing out of China is frozen anyway. It would be frozen as well. But, it, you know, what it requires a certain amount of will, forward thinking, and it requires investment, you know, a bit of a leap of faith. But, you know, these are things that we need to look at. You know, we these are the things that you would hope, you know, however you feel about the tariff for good or evil, you would hope that that this shakeup would potentially cause people to look at the economics of things. But the problem is that it's such a big investment to make a facility be able to process this stuff, and the fisheries management, you know, it's science-based and decisions, you know, changes in quota, et cetera, can be very abrupt. The way that we're managing our fish makes it very risky to make any infrastructure investments in processing a fish. So, you know, we've created a system that makes it difficult to invest in our infrastructure and invest in bringing our fish to the market. So, you know, you mentioned two different items, you know, and I'm bringing them both back to our shores, even though we're, you know, you're talking about me as somebody who's an internationalist, which I am. You know, but I think it's really important to keep in mind that, yes, we need to look at what's happening here on our shores. You know, I think whenever possible, we do need to look at at what's domestic. I'd rather, if I can get fish that's local, I'd rather get fish that's local. I recognize that we have a health crisis because we're not eating enough seafood, not eating nearly enough seafood. And I know that we couldn't eat enough seafood if we relied simply on what is local. So we need to be looking at all of the options, at the international options. And we need to also consider the fact that there are markets that are willing to pay much more than we are. And so exporting our high-value fish, importing lower-value fish, you know, if our sea scallops are going to go to Europe for $20-some-odd dollars a pound, and we're happy with bay scallops out of China at $5 or $6 a pound, I mean, those things are probably healthy. It means that the people who are harvesting the scallops are, you know, are bringing more money into the economy. We're still eating scallops, you know. So, I mean, you know, we need to look at these things, at these patterns, and consider, you know, protectionism isn't necessarily going to get more healthy fish on people's plates, and isn't necessarily going to drive our economy in the best way. Sometimes you can't sort of force things into directions, even though you might make an abstract logical case for it.
Well, Scott, I want to let you jump in, but Richard, I think you just defined something that would be a very useful and intriguing way of using those tariffs, maybe to pay for infrastructure that we could do our own processing instead of reprocessing in international countries. We actually tax our own product. We can maybe pay for things and have some strategy behind it, but I don't think that's there yet. So, Scott, I interrupted.
Yeah, no, sure. Without the benefit of our listeners knowing, you have, I think, a 30-year history in the business that you've been involved in. So you've seen a lot of ups and downs, including the demise of what's been happening with the groundfish industry, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And related to that, the shoreside infrastructure, coming back to your infrastructure point, in places like Gloucester, New Bedford, all up and down the coast, those kinds of things that, to use an agricultural comparison as an analogy, they often say that the last crop a farmer will ever plant is a house. that land's never going to be used for food production, in other words, after that house is built. The same is true, as I see it, on the fisheries side, that once that shoreside infrastructure is lost and condominiums are put in place or a hotel waterfront is put in place, then it's very difficult to maintain working waterfronts. There are some exceptions around. I think there's some developments in Gloucester that are looking at changing that. But nonetheless, the square footage that now is dedicated to condominiums or hotels waterfront is no longer available for the processing infrastructure that it sounds like you're saying we need more of. So I'm curious, how do we flip that dime? How do we get away from the irony of it being less expensive to ship fish thousands of miles and days away, frozen in block often, and then processed and sent back for things to us to eat? And the same thing, and it's true, I think, in the lumber industry, in some ways, in other food sectors, the same kinds of things are happening. Mm-hmm. So how do we change that so that we can give the consumers what they're asking for, and have the consumers recognize that there might be a higher cost associated with that to compensate for access to local food. But in the long run, the value that you get from that investment is much better for you, for your health, and for the economy, and for your own communities, based on your supporting those local businesses.
Oh, God, you've just given me about a dozen jumping off points there. there's a couple things to mention here. First of all, in Massachusetts, we have a law that actually, you know, there are designated port areas, and they're actually, you know, there are prohibitions on developing much of the shoreside properties. And paradoxically enough, that is not helping. In some ways, it's actually hurting, because it makes it almost impossible for the people who own that place to get financing, to get bank financing, because the banks know that you're not going to be able to use this space for very much, and they know that if you can't get fish, you can't process, you're not going to be able to pay back the bank loan. So, you know, we're all in a catch-22, and it all comes back to that question, the uncertainty of supply. What we need to get back to a place where we have certainty that we're going to be pulling a certain amount of volume of fish out of the water. Then you know that you can invest in something and that you are going to be able to get a return on investment. Then you can get banks to loan you. Then you can build. Right now, if you look at New Bedford, if you look at Gloucester, if you look at the shore, you're going to see these are designated port areas. you know, with certain exceptions, they're not building that many hotels, et cetera. And you've got people sort of clamoring to get things out of the designated port areas because they're, basically docks are falling into the ocean. They can't even maintain them because they're not getting enough fish to be able to run enough through to get enough profit to reinvest in their properties. They can't get the banks to put money in. They can't make a case for it because they can't promise they're going to have enough fish.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, you know, coming back to this whole question, you know, if we're talking about fish that is harvested someplace other than, you know, not landed locally for ice, you know, for, you know, to be put on ice, you know, and come off at the dock, you know, if we're bringing it in from open ocean or someplace else, does it make sense to bring it into Massachusetts where we have a higher cost of labor than to bring it to some other place in the country or to bring it into some other place in the world where there is a lower cost or some place where, frankly, the governments will support infrastructure development better than we do?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you know, when you talk about you know, it going to a far-flung place, you know, whether it's China or Indonesia or Malaysia or Brazil or wherever it is, just keep in mind that it costs 25 cents a pound to put product on a ship container and bring it all the way to Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of carbon footprint on a ship container, that's not all that bad. Mm-hmm. So those economics are maybe different than you might think. I mean, it's certainly counterintuitive. But they might be different mm-hmm. than you think. And so don't get me wrong. I mean, you know, we all have, you know, we all need to look at things with our rational mind and we have to look at things with our emotional soul. You know, it's sort of like mm-hmm. when you're thinking about, okay, well, I will eat pigs, but I won't eat dogs. You know, you understand rationally that, you know, that you have an emotional connection with the dog and that you don't with a pig, you know, and so you understand that your mind works one way, your heart works another way, you know, looking at things analytically, you might have a hard time supporting some of your goals in terms of local development and eating local when you look at it analytically and trade-offs. Yes, we need to figure out what are the smart trade-offs and we need to figure mm-hmm. out what are the smart investments because we're not going to get all of them. So, I mean, I want to focus first on locally, and this may, you know, I'm not sure that we want this to be this whole podcast because this is a big issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are, you know, when we're looking at fisheries management, you know, if you look at how industry has collaborated and how they manage, how they've managed and how they've gotten involved in terms of managing the scallop fishery. You know, they look at managing scallops not just as a resource, but they look at managing scallops as inventory. When they're going to harvest it, how they're going to harvest it, how they're going to build it up. They look at it so that they can pull it out of the water, harvest it, and bring it to market. As opposed to sort of this abstract data collection model, turning faucets on and off. So they look at it multiple years. They look at being able to plan it. You know, when you've got a fisherman who's fishing and who's investing and who's just made improvements to the boat they need to pay off over the next 4 years, and then all of a sudden it's a certain day and new data comes in and you say, okay, I'm going to stop. I'm not going to let you fish anything more. You know, we'll figure it out in a year or two. You know, we'll get you, maybe we'll get you disaster funds. We'll let you know in 6 months. You know, when that's the way that we're managing our fisheries and when that's the way that the fishing community has to look at their livelihood and has to look at their business model,
mm-hmm.
that's the biggest limiting factor on how we look at how we're going to be able to fit into this larger global picture.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Couple of things, if I could, Aaron, before we go back. You mentioned DPAs, and I'm curious that you may be aware there's some legislation that's pending now. There's a bill that's been filed. I think it's on the Senate side by Senator Tarr.
Yep.
And on the House side, I think it was by Representative Ferrante.
Yep.
On tax credits for investment
in exactly.
that kind of
yep.
facility. You think that would be something that would help on getting more investment so that we would see some more of that local infrastructure development that ultimately right now has been a challenge with traditional financing?
Yeah, I mean, that is a huge game changer. It's mm-hmm. a huge game changer because it makes it, what it does is it gives developers incentives to find the money.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows banks that people will be able to profit from what they're doing. So it makes it viable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Great. Aaron.
Yeah, Richard, I just want to go back to the point, which I find intriguing, because a lot of these discussions around the global commodity exchange take into account that things will maintain business as usual And I think what we've learned in the last X amount of years is we are in the midst of another aspect of a global tragedy of the commons, where we're overfishing a lot of our key and keystone feature fisheries and international ports. So how are our systems built to adapt and to be nimble to these changing consumer markets, but also if the fish isn't there, we can't pull it in, how are we going to continue to fill these global market exchanges?
Well, gee, you just did the same thing he did. There's an awful lot to unpack from what you said.
Sure.
So first of all, you just said a lot of those fisheries are being overfished. What I've seen is that approximately one-third is and approximately two-thirds aren't.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, you know, there are other organizations that report those numbers very differently.
Mm-hmm.
And the definition of overfishing is something which can be very malleable.
Sure.
You know, the United States, the way they define overfishing, it is basically anything that results in a depletion of the stock. So if you have no fishermen fishing a stock, but the stock declines, it is defined as having been overfished, even though nobody put a net in the water. And that has really negative ramifications for the community because it suggests that the community has been irresponsible. Mm. Right now, the biggest threat to many fish populations, especially in New England and North America, has been global warming.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's been dramatic changes to the habitat. And that has, you know, resulted in challenges to fish in terms of spawning. And you know, you've got a couple of things going. Number one, you absolutely have some populations that are negatively impacted by it. Number two, you've got some instances where fish might be there, but you don't know where they are. And especially the way that we're managing them, because we're looking at the traditional, you know, we're looking in the same places and we're not seeing as many fish. What we might find is that the fish are there, they're just not there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's funny, a couple of years ago, I ran a symposium at the Exchange Center on the Sunday of when we do the Boston Seafood Festival. You know, as a geek, it was a great idea, but, you know, objectively, it was a horrible idea because who wants to go to a symposium on seafood sustainability on a Sunday in the middle of August? I think we had five people because of the air conditioning. But, you know, what was interesting was Andrew Pershing from the Gulf of Maine Research Institute said, you know, you guys might not know this, but there was a state last year that had the largest harvest of cod that it had ever had. And he asked, do you know which state it was? And the answer, and this was 3 years ago or so, the answer was New Jersey. Hmm. Scratch your head. Hmm. And the question was why? And the answer was because it was in deeper water, and deeper water is colder. So the fish went to deeper water, hmm. and the deeper water was in New Jersey. So how well do we know where the fish are right now? Hmm. How do we know where the population is? How are we managing it? You know, we've looked at regional management, and the regional management, you know, suggests that fish are within certain borders. But if they're not, then how valid is our management model, and how valid are our assessments of what exists in terms of fish?
Hmm.
When we're talking about the fact that fisheries management is having trouble adapting its model, I want to be clear that NOAA and NIMS, National Marine Fisheries Service, is the most advanced in terms of fisheries management in the world, and that the actions that they take are very, very beneficial. The money they put into science, the observer programs, we do have a good model. It's just that the challenges of adapting to a rapidly changing environment are ones that would challenge any fisheries managers. So, you know, I want you to understand, overfishing is occurring.
Mm-hmm.
Stock depletions are occurring, especially on the fish at the top of the food chain. Average sizes of swordfish and tuna, et cetera, are going down in many cases. Some of them, the story is good. You know, bluefin tuna here on the Western Atlantic, the news is good. On the Eastern Atlantic, the news is not good. And we need to be careful with certain long-lived species that we don't really know the ramifications when we deplete them. We don't know how they come back. And we don't have enough science to really know. So, you know, having a precautionary attitude is very important.
Mm-hmm.
You asked the question of how do we keep the supply chain full. For me, you know, the more important question is what do we do to keep the species viable?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because the supply chain, the answer is it's always going to be full. We're always going to find another species, or we're going to find the fish from another place, or we're always going to find a way to get fish to the table. And you know what? This market, that's the wonderful thing about seafood. You know, people adapt. They'll find different fish. Tilapia didn't exist 30 years ago, you know, and commercially speaking. And as you said, it took over. Yep. So we'll find something to put on the plate. I'm not worried about that. But I'm worried about how we manage the populations. And one of the things that I think is really important as well is getting people to understand that the exciting thing about seafood is that very idea of diversity and the fact that you can have so many different kinds of fish. Because, you know, a lot of the problems that we've had in terms of fisheries management and fraud, all the problems that we see have come from the fact that consumers think there's only five species of fish that exist. You know, when every consumer wants grouper every day for lunch, what's a restaurant going to do? You know, they're either going to source it in non-responsible ways, or they're gonna close their eyes and ears when somebody says they've got it, when maybe it isn't grouper. But mm-hmm. they're being driven because the consumer is asking them for something that if we were doing our job better, we'd be able to communicate to the consumer, hey, you can have that same experience. There are other fish that can give you the same experience. Mm-hmm. And then we'd obviate the need for them to be, you know, really kind of driving to get that last fish out of the water to be able to put that grouper sandwich on your plate.
A little bit more on the brand. Let's talk about your brand. So Stavis Seafood has been an anchor of the international seafood industry for 90 years. From its origin, Stavis quickly grew from a clam company to a one-stop source for high-quality seafood, now delivering more than 1,000 seafood items nationwide and to more than 48 countries around the globe. Along with their New England roots, Stavis has also been a leading importer into the Florida seafood market, specializing in seafood from Central and South America. Stavis Seafood recently announced a new brand called Sea True that comes in tow with a tagline of high-quality seafood that is completely traceable, socially responsible, and sustainably sourced. So, Richard, could you tell us a little bit more about Sea True and what your objective with launching this around those values of food that we're all connecting with?
Absolutely. And, you know, one thing that I will say is that nothing can put fear in the heart of somebody more than a marketer in the way that they put a phrase out onto the market. you know, Sea True is an incredibly exciting brand for me for a couple of reasons. You know, number one, I've got a 21-year-old daughter. I've got a 20-year-old son. This generation, they have something. They're unique. You know, they have instant access to information and good quality information. They have the ability to form informed opinions, and they make decisions based upon their worldview and their opinions. They want to find the truth. They want to make decisions based on it. This is really, I think, the first generation that isn't making their decisions on what to put in their belly based on price. You know, now, don't get me wrong. If I was in Kentucky instead of in Boston, I'm not sure that I'd be making that statement quite as forcefully. You know, you need to have a certain amount of disposable income, and you need to be a certain, you know, I think that, you know, this is certainly not across all spectrums. But the fact that people can do this, and the fact that there are discussions along these lines, you know, that this knowledge is available and that certain people are using it, I think is incredibly important. And so we have actually called this brand a lifestyle brand, and people scratch their head and they ask, what do we mean? And basically what we mean by that is this is a brand that can align with the value system people, you know, and our goal is to be able to show those consumers who are principled in their purchasing why this product is product they can feel comfortable buying, you know, so that is one component of this, which is really important. And the brand right now is very modest. We have about 5 items. We're really doing our live launch on July 1st. You know, and we're only doing it on items that we're able to, again, identify sustainability, identify, you know, from a traceability side, and identify social responsibility, you know. So, you know, we want to be able to show that. But this brand is also very exciting to me from another perspective as well. You talk about 1,000 items, you know, and we import from a number of countries. We source domestically as well. You know, most of our suppliers and most countries are working to make their supply chain more sustainable, are working to be more responsible in their harvesting. They're all at different points in the spectrum. And our policy as a company is that if you're being responsible, if you're working to improve, if you meet certain criteria, we're going to source that product. That said, different products are at different points along the chain. You know, certain things are going to be at the apex. Certain things are going to be along the way. We want to keep them all in the pipeline, because if we don't, then the people who they're dealing with won't be trying to get them to improve.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, an engagement model, in my mind, engagement models are very, very powerful, very important. So I see this brand as the best way to motivate our suppliers to improve their practices, to get them to earn their way into the brand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the brand is very new. You know, ultimately, I hope that we're going to be able to give them a better return, and we're going to give them an incentive to improve their practices to earn their way into that brand. So for me, I see this as a way, I don't know if it's evolutionary or revolutionary, but I see this as a way of driving change.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so it's funny. You know, the marketing and the sales department is very excited about connecting with consumers and being able to get, you know, drive sales, which of course, I mean, that's the lifeblood. That doesn't happen. We're not in business next year. I'm looking at it from the perspective of driving change on the water, driving change in the supply chain. You know, so there's two very compelling and very exciting aspects of this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And one thing, and this is kind of, and you know, you were talking about this before, and we've all talked about it. You know, one of the real challenges is, okay, so we say sustainable, we say traceable, we say socially responsible. Well, what the heck does that mean? You know, just putting, you know, I mean, at this point, there are dozens of little logos and stuff, you know, and a consumer really can't keep up with them. And how do they know this one's better than that one? How do they know, and how do they make sense of it? You know, what we've done with this brand, and this is something that is building on what was before they imploded, what was going to be our Clinton Global Initiative partnership agreement. Basically, it's a concept of responsibility that allows consumers to get pretty granular information. And basically what it is it's a box. It has an R on one side of the box, so it explains to the consumers it's met our criteria of responsibly harvested, and a QR code next to it. Click under the QR code, takes you to a landing page. And then that landing page gives you granular information. So when we say sustainable, does that mean it's certified? And again, you're the people who are listening might not know. I might be getting too wonky here, and I apologize if I am. But you might have seen the MSC bullet, the little blue bullet. So is it certified? Does it have that? Is it Monterey Bay Aquarium ranked? You know, if you have the card, is it going to be green on that? You know, or you know, the thing that I like the most is what's called the Fishery Improvement Project. Is it an instance where that entire supply chain has gotten together and they've been improving the fishery in a transparent way where you as a consumer can drive right in and see exactly what they've done and the progress out there? Is that how we consider it to be sustainable? And you can see why we consider this to be sustainable for this product on that QR code. You know, you can see why we consider it to be traceable. You can see when social responsibility, you know, basically we do a screening in terms of, you know, that's based on the Department of Labor and what countries they consider to be at risk, what countries they consider to be okay. And then we take further actions based on at-risk countries, and we'll explain what further actions we've taken, and we'll explain why we consider this to be safe. And the great thing about this, because these are ever-changing, you know, this is going to evolve, is that label is going to look the same. The R in the box is going to be the same on that label. But next week, if we're evolving it, if we're advancing it, we can change what we have on the back end. You know, every day when you look at it, you can see new and better information as to why this product is sustainable and responsible. And so, you know, so this allows us to connect with the consumer in a meaningful way. You know, I don't want to shove information down a consumer's throat. Many consumers have a very limited attention span. If all they want to know is that it's met our muster, you know, past our criteria, that's all they're going to see.
Yeah.
If they want to know on a more in-depth level, they're going to get as much information as they want, and it's not just going to be sort of a pat on the head and a pat on the butt, sending them on their way.
Yep. Scott, I want to come back to you for final thoughts, but before we do that, I want to ask Richard. So you are currently the chief sustainability officer. Are we going to expect to see you as the chief responsibility officer in the near future? And what can we expect to see from Stavis in the next 3 to 5 years?
I've learned I've learned that the minute that you sort of put out your vision, you have to realize that you're not going to get exactly there. You know, that you never end up exactly where you are. You know, I sort of, you know, what I sort of envisioned is kind of a hierarchy, and people laugh when I say it, but I sort of think about when you get onto a plane and, you know, and they always say, you know, if in the case of a changing pressure, you know, take the oxygen mask, put it on yourself first and put it on somebody else. In my mind, the first thing we all need to do is we all need to be healthy, and we all need to be eating seafood and be engaged in this to be healthy ourselves. Otherwise, we can't help anybody else in the world, period. Mm-hmm. Next, we need to be looking at the people who bring this product to the market, and we need to make sure they're dealt with respect and dignity, that they have their rights, that they have enough food, enough money, medical care, et cetera. So next, we need to look at the social responsibility side of things. Then we need to look at the sustainability side, you know, both fish and ecosystem management. So, you know, I hope that what's going to happen is not just Stavis's policy, but that everybody's policy is going to evolve in that way. And my guess is that the social responsibility part is going to come. The nutrition part, for some reason, when I mention to most people, they scratch their head. They don't get that aspect of it. But in my mind, it's just, it, you know, there's just so many studies. It's just so clear. I mean, you know, we gotta look at ourselves. We just have to. Yeah. So I hope we get there.
Yeah, that's a great place to start, and I like the analogy. I mean, we're getting nowhere if we're preaching to people to start eating better food and we're eating processed junk food and not worried about some of our best health food coming from our, even here in New England, our local waters, but really anywhere. I mean, this is a great source of excellent, delicious protein that can be accessible by many. So, Scott, final thoughts?
Sure, yeah. I first and foremost want to thank Richard and Stavis for raising the bar. You guys, as the aggregators and distributors of the product, consumers are going to be coming to you to look for the product. So the fact that you give them the ability to, however they define sustainable or access to fish, that they can do that by looking at the information themselves, I think that's key. Because let's face it, the only reason I think the codfish or the image of it is hanging in the State House is largely because we had so much codfish here to begin with when the first European settlers came here. The reality is, if it were dogfish like we have now, where there's a quarter that's under-harvested, we'd likely have a dogfish hanging in the State House right now. So the ability to educate consumers and to give them the ability to really look at and try these great, high-quality sea protein products that Stavis supplies and others is a key opportunity to getting them to actually ask and seek more of that. So instead of asking for that grouper sandwich, they might ask for a dogfish taco the next time they go in if they see that see that on the menu. But the exposure opportunities are the things that Stavis, the kind of player that you are in the industry, in the market, can do, is key to making that change. So I agree wholeheartedly with you as the concept of being a change agent to make that happen. Because as a leader in the industry, you and your colleagues, the other industries around here, especially in Massachusetts, where we look at fish and seafood being such a big part of our food system, are going to be the key change agents to making that happen, to giving the consumers the ability to ultimately get out there and identify, know the product, know the producer, and know just how their food is brought to them. So kudos to you for the work that you're doing.
Thank you.
Scott, yeah, I agree, but the cod is a little more of a sexy fish. I mean, the monkfish and some of the bottom feeders aren't necessarily the best-looking things. You can only put a certain amount of lipstick on that pig, right? I mean, there's a certain element of, like, the aesthetics matter.
Dogfish are pretty sexy.
They are kind of sharks, after all. Tough, yeah. Right? Yeah, I got it. Richard, where can our listening audience learn more about what you're up to at Stavis and your new product line? Where can we find some of your delicious seafood?
First of all, www.stavis.com is a good place to learn about Stavis and about what we're doing. You know, the funny thing is that we have always sort of specialized in selling to the restaurants, selling to the people who are expert in it. We're getting into retail and we're newer in terms of getting into it. And the what I would ask for consumers is to go to their retailers and say that they need that see-through brand and bootstrap it to get the retailers to get it. Because the truth is, you're not going to find it right now. If you feel like this is a compelling business model, if you feel like this is something that would be meaningful to you, you're going to have to help make it happen. That would be my suggestion. You know, you will find it in some, you know, I know that we have one or two retailers who have already signed on the bottom line, even though it hasn't, and even though it's not officially rolling out till July 1st. And I'd be more than happy to update you if you have a way of getting it to your listeners after the fact, if that's something that...
Yeah, well, yeah. We can update it on the profile and the write-up and also on our iTunes account. So I'd be happy to put that on there. I'll just close by saying I really like your strategy. And to Scott's point, you know, kudos to you. You've had a long mainstay in this area, which is known globally, and New England being global representation in seafood. The fact that you're working on things to motivate suppliers to do better, to drive change, working on this capacity building of a future fishery, trying to add those values back into this unbelievable health food that we don't take full advantage of. We take it for granted often. So what an opportunity for us, our businesses, our kids, to experience a better interaction and engagement with our oceans and our fisheries. So I just want to thank you for taking the time to share this wisdom with myself and Scott and our listening audience. I learned a great deal. I know our listening audience will as well. So thanks, Richard.
Well, no, thank you. This has been enjoyable. And I'd love to come again if you ever want to see me.
Eat more fish.
Thank you.